This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Up next, the man who wrote the book, well, the books, rather, on data visualization. He was doing infographics before everybody was doing infographics. Back in the 80s, data scientist Edward Tufte remortgaged his house so he could start a company and self-publish his first book, The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. Sound like a snoozer? Well, that book, along with his others on the same topic, have sold more than 1.5 million copies. And over 100,000 people have paid to hear his seminar on data visualization. His ideas, keep it simple, get rid of the chart junk, have made him a legend in design circles. But E.T., as he's known, isn't just interested in data. He's an artist, a sculptor, and now he's working on a new project called The Thinking Eye. He joins us now. Edward Tufte, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for coming. Tell us how you describe your work.
Most of my work has been secretly about trying to make people smarter. And it means smart both in terms of science and seeing and information and art. Science and art, at least at a high level, have in common intense seeing and bright-eyed observing and deep curiosity. And I'm starting to now surface these ideas that have been lurking in my work for so long in my project, The Thinking Eye, which will be a book movie. It's going so slowly that I think books and movies will be the same by the time I get it done.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that, but let me give out the number again because I'm sure a lot of people will have questions for you. It's 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. What's The Thinking Eye all about?
Well, first it's about how to see intensely, this bright-eyed observing and curiosity. And then what follows after that is reasoning about what one sees and asking, what's going on here? And in that reasoning intensely, it involves also a skepticism about one's own understanding. The thinking eye must always ask, how do I know that? That's probably the most powerful question of all time. How do you know that? And then finally, the creative thinking eye escapes itself and produces and executes, teaches a class, writes an article, makes a visualization, creates an artwork. Tweets, however, probably don't count.
You know, we have a lot of observers in our audience, professionals and lay people observers. So let's start with that seeing part. Do you have suggestions for how we can see better? Just that first part.
The great big thing is to try to devote most of one's brain processing power to the seeing. That is, as we know from all the studies of cell phones and driving automobiles, people don't do very well in seeing how where they're going when they're talking. And so deep seeing requires a fairly a certain serenity of oneself, but also a serene environment. And in that way, all the brain's processing power can be devoted to seeing. I had this experience, almost a magical experience. I had was walking out on our farm by a long stone wall, and I said to my friend, let's just not talk. And for the first 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, what you start to hear is simply the sound that the inner ear makes. And then after a while you hear things, just the slightest rustling of leaves. But what happened to seeing after maybe 10 minutes of just seeing, not talking, not doing anything else, was it was like the light became perfect. Like when you have filtered light from the sun, the shadows don't blow out to dark and the brights don't go out to white, but everything, you know, is in focus and not blown out. But now it was as if, because you were seeing so much better, because all your brain power was devoted to it, it was like you were creating a perfect light for seeing. That is, you could see the details in the shadow, and you could protect the eye against blowing out to brightness. And that's one of the main things. If you want to see well, you've got to, you know, go all out, you know, really be highly focused on just on that and not doing anything else.
Zip it, in other words.
Yeah, and also the environment itself should be, you know, quiet. I think the hardest place in the world to see is at an art gallery reception, an art gallery party, because of the chaos and the din, and it's simply impossible to see the artworks on the wall.
Is seeing better related to thinking more clearly?
Well, I sure think so. That's why I call it the thinking eye. In some ways, seeing is thinking. The light comes in through the lens and is focused on the retina, and the retina is pretty much working like brain cells. It's processing, and then the two optic nerves are sending what we now know are 20 megabits a second of information back to the brain. That's sure a lot better than my Wi-Fi at home. And so the scene right then is being transformed into information, into thinking, right as that step from the retina to the brain. And the brain is really busy, and it likes to economize, and so it's quick to be active and jump to conclusions. So if you're told what to look for, you can't see anything else. So one thing is to see in a way without words. That avoids the confirmation bias where, that once you have a point of view, all history will back you up. And that's the eye and brain busy economizing on those 20 megabits a second that are coming in.
Does that mean seeing things and not labeling them either?
I think there's a lot of premature labeling. Mm. Now, the situation in teaching is different. You're trying to point out where people should see. But analytical seeing, I believe you should try to stay in the sheer optical experience as long as possible. Once you have an idea or somebody tells you something to look for, that's about all you can see. I had this experience recently. A dear friend of ours has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I hadn't seen her for about 6 months. And when she came and visited, I couldn't see her anymore. I was always looking now for symptoms, how the dementia was manifesting itself. And I mean, I know about how words control seeing, and I couldn't see her through any other lens but, you know, the possible symptoms. Mm-hmm. And that one word, that one piece of knowledge, totally, and I was self-aware of it, but it still totally corrupted every time I looked at Sigrid.
Mm. A lot of people want to ask you questions, so let's go to the phones to Springfield, Virginia. And Ricky, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is, have you seen good examples of data visualizations and digital experience, either on the web or mobile? And what are the pitfalls or potential issues with data visualizations in a digital medium?
Good question.
I don't think the issues involve being digital. In other words, it doesn't really matter the analytical issues, whether you're, you know, scratching a piece of stone or on a piece of paper or on a computer screen. I have been recently, partly at the end of the year, but also thinking more broadly, I think probably the best visualization ever are Feynman diagrams. They show nature's subatomic behavior. They've been used for 70 years by scientists, and they thankfully replace a lot of hairy mathematics. I think there's been, obviously, the digital world has opened up more possibilities with visualizations, but some of the most spectacular visualizations were done of all in 1610 by Galileo as he made these made his remarkable discoveries. So visualization is timeless, and the principles for showing information are like nature's laws are timeless. So we can, I think I can learn more, a lot more sometimes from 1610 and Galileo than I can learn from the last 5 years of looking at visualizations. The main thing that's happened is the information throughput and the information resolution has gone up enormously in the last decade. And I view high resolution pretty much like being smart. So that, you know, we talk about high-risk people, but that's where visualizations have been helped by much higher data throughputs. I think resolution is not everything, but it's really important, really, and our screens have become close to magical now in terms of resolution.
The Feynman diagrams, you made sculptures, which you can see pictures of those on our website at sciencefriday.com if you'd like to see Edward Tufte's sculptures of some of those Feynman diagrams. Do those count as what you call forever knowledge? And explain that term.
That phrase has meant a lot in my own life. Years ago, I was at the Center for Advanced Study, and I wrote a manuscript, and I showed it to Bob Merton, the great sociologist, and he wrote on the margin that this was an echo of some very famous work. I did not take that as a particular compliment. I took that as telling me, play in the big leagues. And what that meant to me was to be like, in a way, like science, which the findings of which are forever, because the laws of nature apply to every particle in the universe forever. And so knowledge about that is, in a sense, forever knowledge. And that I wanted to stop worrying about this quarter's latest journal of whatever it was, or what is topical, or what's in the New York Times this week. I wanted to do things that had that universality and foreverness of science. And so I've been ever since preoccupied with how the fundamental tasks of thinking can be replicated in our designs of information so that our architectures support learning about causality. That's a forever cognitive task. Our architecture support making comparisons, which is a fundamental forever task. Our displays help us assess the credibility of a display. And how do they know that? That's a forever task. So it's that. In other words, the mind information relationship and learning from evidence, optical evidence, is a forever problem.
I'm Flora Lichtman. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Edward Tufte. Sorry, I rudely interrupted you there to pay the bills, as I would say.
I'm awaiting the next question here from our callers.
Okay, well then I think we should go to the phones. How about to Mark in Salt Lake City, Utah?
Yes, hello. I just want to say, Mr. Tufte, you are a true inspiration and a wonderful person. I think you're one of the most fascinating people on our planet today.
Well, that's very kind. I hope I don't screw it up.
I don't think so. I just really am curious to know. You know, I used to be a graphic designer when I was at the university, at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, and we were all big fans of you down there. And what's your background? How did you get your start, and how did you fall into what you do today? I've just always been very curious to know that.
Thanks for calling, Mark.
I don't quite know how I ever arrived like this. In a rough sense, I just go to the studio every day and go to work. That it's very hands-on. My background comes, my mother is a professor of English emeritus at the University of Southern California. My father was a civil engineer. They had also very good taste about furniture and things, even though they were both the youngest of ten children on a farm. They had a very elegant and gracious eye. And it seems like I've always bumped into the right people all along. I've always tried to celebrate excellence in any field I went into and go to the best people as soon as I could and listen to them. I've been involved in a lot of things, usually at a reasonably high level. And I never got trapped by the disciplinary chauvinism of the university world. The world is much more interesting than any one discipline, and I'm interested and curious in so many of the things in the world. And
Hold that thought, because we have to take a quick break, but we'll be back to hear more about it. Thank you. We're talking with Edward Tufte, data scientist, the Galileo of graphics, the Da Vinci of data, as he's been called. What are your questions for Dr. Tufte? 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman, talking with Edward Tufte. Dr. Tufte, I want to get your thoughts on some of the current superstars in data and design. Did you follow Nate Silver's blog this presidential season, the 538?
Yes, I followed his work for years, and I thought, actually, I gave some awards the data table of the year I gave to his a data table that he did after the election based on the real data, and I thought it was this extraordinary summary of the event. It was even better than some of the tables on ESPN.com. It was a terrifically well-designed table that described the election. He's a very wise person. Predictions are very difficult, and it's easy to get your head knocked off, and you're out there on the high wire. And then the other thing is he is just marvelously productive in producing things that people want to know about. And he's also able to separate his own political views from the predictions. That's usually where people go wrong. They get a little optimistic for their side. And he made the separation.
What about Steve Jobs? What do you think of the approach that he took towards design?
I think it was extraordinary. His approach was different from everyone else's, which is to start with the user experience and work backwards to the technology. I always, and likewise in my own work, I am utterly indifferent to the methodology of producing visualizations, and all I care about is the relationship between the viewer's brain and the intellectual tasks and the material at the hand as it's presented. And this is outside in design, that you design the surface. That's what the user sees after all. You design the surface first, and then you view the software as simply, you know, hey, is there any software out there that can solve the problem? Most displays are designed the other way around. The government starts out to refereeing among application solutions, desperately looking for a problem to solve, and what the user sees is a kind of byproduct of software houses. Steve Jobs started at the relevant point. It's all about the relationship between the viewer and the information on the screen and the viewer's cognitive tasks in looking at that information.
Is there data that can't be visualized well?
Not if you allow artists into the arena. The kinds of more subtle emotional grander symbolic things, but for those kinds of things, I think art does very powerfully. I think, of course, of Picasso's Guernica, one of the best few paintings of the 20th century, and probably the best thing about the horror of war ever done, the unspeakable horrible war. But there it is in Guernica.
Have you felt like there have been times in your career where you have such high standards, it seems, and I think that's why so many people admire your work so much, but have you felt like there have been times when you've been too uncompromising in your principles, that you've lost an opportunity somehow because of that?
The opportunities I wouldn't want. I used to do a lot of consulting, and I consulted at one time to nearly everybody a long time ago, but I couldn't get much done as an outsider. I was a corporate consultant to IBM for a long time, and I learned a lot from them, and I didn't think I taught them enough. But a big company, changing IBM was like trying to change Sweden. And it would require, diplomatic and bureaucratic work that I'm not good at, and some accommodation. And that's just not me. I'm at my best on a kind of innocent and contrary posture, I think, a wide-eyed but somewhat skeptical posture. And that's not doesn't work in much of the world today.
Thank you for joining us today, Edward Tufte.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Good.
It's a pleasure to talk.
Okay. Bye.
That was Edward Tufte, data scientist based in Connecticut.